Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of February. This hour of the program, the health care reform law. There have now been four rulings on whether or not this health care reform is constitutional. All four judges looked at the same legislative provisions, the constitutional clauses, and the precedents of the court. Two decisions from judges appointed by Democratic presidents upheld the law. Two from judges appointed by Republicans struck down part or all of the law. So what's going on here? Our guest says the composition of the court has not changed since last year, nor has the meaning of the Commerce Clause or the decades of precedents interpreting that doctrine or the words of the Affordable Health Care Act itself. The only thing that has shifted between the filing of the Obama health care suits and Judge Roger Vinson's decision finding the entire bill unconstitutional is the odds. We went from a less than 1% chance of the suits succeeding to their success being determined by a coin flip in Anthony Kennedy's chambers. This hour of the program, Dahlia Lithwick will be joining us, senior editor of Slate.com, and she is author of Jurisprudence, The Law, Lawyers, and the Court. We'll look at this in some detail, the first hour of the program. Hour number two of the show, Ronald Reagan would have celebrated his 100th birthday on Sunday of this week, and we will have a political science professor who's written a book about Ronald Reagan, mostly favorable book, hour number two of our show. Both hours, you're welcome to join this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So we have two judges who are Republicans saying this is unconstitutional, two who are Democrats saying that this is okay, it is constitutional. Is there any way to look at this other than, oh, have we got politics involved here?
It's very difficult. You know, I'm impressed because there's always, every morning, you know, there's some op-ed by some constitutional scholar who says, no, this isn't about politics, it's about the Constitution.
Right.
So certainly, I think there are good people making a yeoman's effort to disentangle this from politics. But as you say, you know, not only have the judges who've heard this so far split down strictly partisan lines, but most of the state attorney generals who have supported the Florida lawsuit, the one that came down last week, also split on partisan lines. So they're mostly Republicans supporting the suit. So it's just awfully complicated to unbraid the politics and the ideology from the constitutional conversation.
Exactly. Well, today's constitutional expert is Lawrence Tribe of the New York Times, who says he looks at, since the New Deal, the court has held consistently that Congress has broad constitutional power to regulate interstate commerce.
And he's right. You know, Tribe's piece is in effect, you know, the what you read at the beginning, you know, the idea that this is an 8-1 court, that these issues have been resolved for 80 years, and that the court is going to come down, you know, 8-1 or 7-2 in support of the Health Care Act, because these issues are long settled. And, you know, if you read Larry Tribe's piece, he sort of says, anything that you could analogize this to, like Social Security, for instance, the court has already recognized that, of course, Congress could regulate it. So in Tribe's view, if you look at this as a strictly doctrinal matter, this is a slam dunk. And so I think that while that strand of the conversation is going on, and Tribe's is by no means alone, there's an awful lot of constitutional scholars who say this is a Hail Mary, this is never going to get even two votes at the court. I think the national conversation, the public political conversation, puts this at a 5-4 with Kennedy in the middle.
Isn't it, though, problematic for the court to even be seen as looking at this along partisan political lines after the Florida election?
Well, it certainly is. And I think that as we step back and try to tease out what's going on at the court, even if you bracket the conversation that tribe is having, you know, put aside the doctrinal issues, there are so many reasons that the U.S. Supreme Court wants to be very, very careful about doing another Bush v. Gore, about jumping in early and making what appear to be one-time-only rules that satisfy their ideological ends. So it's not simply that, you know, they're constrained by their own precedent, but I think you're quite right. The court is well aware that its own legitimacy rests on the idea that they don't decide things the way state attorneys general do. They don't decide things the way elected representatives do. And for them to, I think, make the mistake of Bush v. Gore again, which is to say, oh, the public doesn't care, is a very risky proposition only 11 years later.
Mm-hmm. What is happening? Now we have about 26 states who have said they think this is unconstitutional. We have some states who are doing nothing to get this all in place, and they will need to get it in place or the federal government will just take over. What's happening with various states concerning this? Are many of them just saying, we're not doing anything?
Well, there's a lot going on, and there's a good piece in Politico today that tries to unpack what the various states are doing. Some states are, as you say, just going along with the requirements of the federal government because the alternative is to have the federal government do it themselves, and that might be a worse outcome, even if you oppose the health care plan. There are other states that are obstructing it. There are states like my own home state of Virginia that have sent in detailed letters requesting clarification and requesting exemptions from certain things. So I think it differs quite dramatically on the ground, but I think, you know, underlying your question, there is this real fear on the part of even the states that are most opposed to the health reform program, that if they obstruct it in ways that are really meaningful, they're going to just be left out of the party, that this is going to happen around them, and that once the most popular provisions kick in and possibly public sentiment starts to change, they're going to be sort of have been left by the curb. And that's particularly acute, I think, in states where you're seeing, and this is the thrust, I think, of today's political story, you have sort of state governors and other state legislators who are not all that confident that Obama's going to be defeated in 2012. Right. And unless you're confident that he's going to be defeated or that the health law is repealed, you're now making a very, very tricky political calculus, not a legal calculus, about how much you want to be seen obstructing the law.
We have done several shows. Wendell Potter was on some weeks ago, and as you know, he did this expose on the insurance industry. He kept saying repeatedly that wait until the new members of Congress take over. The health insurance lobby is so incredibly strong, and he went so far as to say that they had essentially written the health care reform bill. They're going to change their minds about this. Where does the health insurance industry fit in, and is it just that they haven't had enough time to do their lobbying?
I think that's right. I mean, that sounds like exactly what I've been hearing, which is, you know, at the end of the day, you're going up against a health insurance lobby that got the bill they wanted. They got this market-based bill, and that they haven't weighed in on this question, at least the constitutional question as it's burbling up in the courts, and that as they weigh in, it's going to become very, very clear that the alternatives are worse for them. I do think that one of the things that is so interesting about at least the constitutional conversation as it has happened, and, you know, you noted it's changed so very quickly from, you know, a constitutional law shot to a constitutional even money, is how many voices are not participating. In other words, we're hearing very, very strong, I think, Tea Party voices. There's this individual rights voice that has really surged to the front of the conversation. You know, the idea that the individual mandate must be unconstitutional. It's different. No one has ever been forced to purchase anything. So that's the voice we're hearing over and over again. But there are so many other players in this conversation. I think they've largely, including the insurance industry, been asleep at the switch. Mm. And so what you're hearing is the loudest voices are these very, very, very determined individual liberty voices. You know, that's, for for instance, Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General of the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia. But that's not the only player with an interest in this. And so I think as this plays out, we're going to hear a lot of the voices that have been very, very silent and on the sidelines start to participate.
We keep hearing both sides, but particularly conservatives, cite these polls all the time. And the Weekly Standard had a piece, which I'm sure you saw, saying that it's at the grassroots that Obama's health care program is most unpopular. Its poll numbers fell in 2009, worsened in 2010, haven't improved in 2011. A Senate Majority Leader, this article says, Harry Reid, claims that 80% of Americans oppose repeal, but that isn't even close to being true. They go on to cite a CNN poll, 50% of all Americans favor repeal, another poll at 48%, another at 46%, and health care has become the issue uniting Republicans, just as the party has gained, according to Gallup, a net positive image for the first time since 2005. What do you make of all of that?
Well, it's a Rorschach test. I think we can all read into that polling exactly what we want to read into it. I think at the heart of the matter, there is a profound problem the administration has had with messaging this. I think that the opponents of health reform did a really good job, right down to the name Obamacare, you know, right down to the basic, you know, first principles of what was wrong with this. You know, I can certainly tell you, you know, I sort of joke that every radio call-in show that I've done in the last 7 or 8 months, you know, the calls run 8 to 2, 9 to 1, saying this thing is illegal. You can't force people to do this. So I think that it is absolutely the case that whatever the Obama administration did right about this, what they did wrong came in the sales department. They didn't market this in a way that sort of pointed out to Americans, look, this is certainly better than the status quo, and the other side has failed to put up any alternatives. Instead, I think almost from the beginning, we've heard the drumbeat of, you know, this is the beginning of the end of personal liberty. And that's been a pretty effective sell. So, you know, the question now becomes, as I said, as pieces of it kick in, parents are allowed to keep their kids on their insurance longer. Pre-existing conditions start to not be a valid basis to decline someone. As those things start to happen, if they start to happen, you may see some of those polling numbers shift.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, don't take that away from us. How dare you take that away?
Well, that's been, you know, I think that's been the hope, and it's one of the reasons, you know, going back to your earlier question, that the administration is essentially warning the state governors who oppose this, you know, this is coming, because I think that that's the hope. But, you know, it doesn't, none of this is helped by the fact that this is hurtling through the courts, that it's being decided in very, very strong and, I think, ideological language on both sides. And so it appears as though this is, you know, a constitutional question first and foremost. And I think Americans are taking a lot of their cues from the language that they read in Judge Vinson's decision in Florida, Judge Hudson's decision in Virginia. You know, when you have federal judges saying this is, you know, a short hop from forcing Americans to eat broccoli, I think that that does affect the polling.
Well, maybe we should eat broccoli.
Don't even go there. That's the, you know, the end of personal liberty is the beginning of forced vegetation. It is an amazingly interesting framing that has taken over here, where the idea that if the government can force you to purchase health insurance, right, what the opponents of the law call they're regulating inactivity, your decision to do nothing, and the idea that that is if that is permitted, that is akin to the government saying, we can force you, we'll knock on your door and make sure you're eating spinach. And that idea has caught on in such a deep
yes.
way, not just in the legal circles, but I think just in the common conversation. It's been, I've never seen a kind of constitutional framing happen so quickly and so effectively.
Right. Now, tell me if you read the history the same way. I was reading an article yesterday about the history of individual mandate. And the idea was that conservatives, that we go back to the early 90s, and conservatives proposed the individual mandate, which says that everybody who can afford health care insurance has to buy it, because they were opposed to the Clinton health care plan back in the early 90s. So that's the role individual mandate played for all of those years. It was what the Republicans favored as a smaller government alternative to a health care plan that the Clintons proposed. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. I mean, this was Mitt Romney's health care plan. This was, without question, a plan that was thought up and initially, I think, sold by conservatives. It was a market-based plan that was an alternative to, you know, a Canadian or single-payer system where the government would, in fact, run it. I mean, I think one thing that is important, and certainly conservative legal scholars would say, that there is one difference between the Massachusetts plan and the Obama plan, and that is that states do have vast, vast police powers to regulate all sorts of things that the federal government doesn't. And so I think that sometimes supporters of the health care reform bill say, look, this is absolutely no different from what Mitt Romney supported in Massachusetts and what has actually been, I think, very, by every metric, successful in Massachusetts. But as a constitutional question, there is a difference between what states can force you to do under their police powers, under this idea, broad idea that states can regulate health and welfare, and the federal government cannot do those things. So I think it's a little bit facile to make that comparison and say it's exactly the same. One of the things that I think the states' rights folks are arguing here is it's completely okay for states to enact this. It's not okay for the federal government to enact it. That's not a deal-breaking argument, but I think it's an argument that's been missed in some of this discussion.
Mm-hmm. And if you didn't have the individual mandate part of this legislation, would the whole thing unravel?
Well, that's one of the questions. I mean, certainly I think that the Obama administration has always taken the position that you can't do anything else unless you have the individual mandate. The rest of the law falls apart. Now, that got turned on its head last week when Judge Vinson in Florida, you know, there was a choice in both the two decisions that have struck down health care reform. There was a choice. It's called a severability provision that allows the judge who's reviewing the law to sever or to cut out the part that he finds unconstitutional from the rest of the law. What was dramatic about the Florida decision last week is that the judge said, I can't sever the unconstitutional bits from the constitutional bits. And so because I find the individual mandate to be unconstitutional, I'm chucking the whole law. This was a profound difference from what Judge Henry Hudson did in Virginia in December. He said, yes, the individual mandate is unconstitutional. No, the law doesn't have a severability clause, which has been a source of sort of inside baseball fretting why the Congress didn't write this law with a provision that would sever the unconstitutional parts from the constitutional parts. So Judge Hudson severed it. Judge Vinson did not. He threw the whole law out. And one of the reasons that he did that is he said, I'm going to hoist the Obama administration on its own petard. If it says the law doesn't work without the individual mandate, I'm going to say the law does not work without the individual mandate and throw the whole thing out. So he flipped it on its head and in effect said, we can't pull out the bits and pieces of this huge, huge piece of legislation that are constitutional and separate them from those that aren't. So the whole thing has to go.
Let's find out what the audience thinks. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Delia Lithwick is our guest, senior editor of Slate.com, author of Jurisprudence, The Law, Lawyers, and the Court. Did I give you the email? talk@wpr.org. We are having a full line of phones ringing, so just keep trying to get through, and eventually you will. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, Robert Collins, will be joining us, professor of history at the University of Missouri and author of Transforming America, Politics and Culture in the Reagan Years. We have a lot of presidential conversations going on this week, Thursday at 10. a look at maybe one of the worst, if not the worst, president. We can talk about that. Andrew Johnson. At least that's what the woman who wrote the book about him, who is our guest, says about this president who followed one of the best, if not the best, Abraham Lincoln. All right, let's go to phone calls. Lou in Cudahy, our first caller. Hi, Lou.
Hello. This is what we get when we hire an activist to be president instead of a leader. Activists don't think they have to obey the law or court orders, and it's breathtaking to think that this administration would sit in contempt of the justice system and do this kind of thing. But frankly, it's not surprising. With the oil drilling moratorium that Obama put in place, that was declared beyond the scope of the administration's ability to put a moratorium on it, and yet they continue right on to do it. And they just their operatives in the administration said, we're going to continue to implement it. The heck with the law. The heck with the courts.
Well, it hasn't worked its way through the courts yet, Lou.
I'm sorry?
It hasn't worked its way through the courts yet. It's not settled.
But the moratorium was said to be beyond the ability of the Constitution, the constitutional authority of the administration to do it. It's just amazing.
And no, but Lou, just to interrupt, I think that's not right. The judge had the choice to enjoin the entire law. He didn't do that. So there's no effect of his decision. There's nothing Obama's not in contempt of anything. The judge explicitly said, I'm not going to enjoin the law from going forward. And so the judge did not take an action that the president is in contempt of. So I think that's not quite accurate. What the judge said is, I think this is unconstitutional. Now it goes up to the Court of Appeals to decide that matter. But there is no action that he took that bars the health care bill from going forward.
And tell me what the process is judicially. Where does it go now? When does it get to the Supreme Court?
Well, that's one of the things that becomes really interesting, and it goes back to your initial question about, what the Supreme Court is going to do. Now there's a little bit of a foot race going on between the Virginia lawsuit that was decided in December and the Florida lawsuit that was decided last week. One of the things that happened this week was Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general who brought the Virginia suit, is trying to fast-track it to the Supreme Court. In other words, he wants to skip the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and take it right to the Supreme Court, saying, this is a matter of huge public importance, and as your caller suggested, this needs to be settled right now. And so there is some chance, although I think it's a very, very slim one, that the court agrees to hear it without having it go to the Intermediate Court of Appeals.
Mm.
Most likely what's going to happen is this will play out, go to the appeals courts. There are other suits in the hopper that may go to the appeals courts. The Supreme Court, in deciding which of the two cases it wants to take, whether it wants to take the case that comes up through the 11th Circuit or through the 4th Circuit, has to make also some strategic decisions about how it wants to hear this case. The two cases raise slightly different issues, and so that becomes interesting. So one of the things that court watchers are going to watch now is whether it's the Hudson suit or the Vinson suit that goes up to the court. And again, one of the things that's in question is whether we skip the intermediate appeals courts. I don't think we will. And so then there is, I think, fairly evident end game here, which is that it gets to the Supreme Court, possibly in 2012. And then there's a whole other set of questions, as we said, about what the justices are going to do with these very, very novel and interesting claims.
For the sake of having everybody know what they ought to be doing right now rather than perhaps dismantling something a few years from now, would it make sense to fast-track this or not?
Well, it sort of depends on your point of view. I think that Lou would say it makes sense to fast-track it because we need a definitive and final answer on this thing, and we need it today. Justice Ginsburg, at a speech earlier in the week, this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, suggested that there are reasons that the court almost never takes a request to fast-track a case, that one of the important roles that the intermediate appeals courts play in this whole process is refining the issues, thinking through where the judges got them right, got it wrong, clarifying things that the judge may have been wrong about, so that in effect you really do benefit as a Supreme Court from another set of eyes reviewing it. So even though it adds to the amount of time that it takes, it also adds to the sharpness and the crispness of the questions that come before the court. And I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not one to sort of talk out of school. And so if she is saying, I think it's not necessarily a wise thing for the court to take this on a fast-track basis, what she is telling, you know, the Virginia Attorney General is, I don't think this is going to happen this year.
Ray is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Yeah, I supported Mr. Obama in the election. I'm a union person, and I want to explain to you clearly why this makes me so angry. The logic of the individual mandate, which is what we are arguing about, says the individual mandate is there so that we can have a larger pool of people to ensure the people that need a huge amount of care, which makes sense. But the largest pool would have been the public option, and the spineless people in Washington did not fight for it. What they fought for was to ensure the continuation of huge profits to the insurance companies, which are the middlemen and provide zero health care. But we have locked into law that they are going to be profitable for, you know, two, three centuries into the future. This law is unconstitutional. The whole thing is insane without the public option.
Could we go back to the public option if this is ruled unconstitutional?
I mean, one of the great ironies of this is that, you know, the court has already held that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, well within Congress's purview. So there's certainly, I think that the caller is quite right that this is a constitutionally questionable solution. I don't think it's a hard question. I'm with Lawrence Tribe. I think this is a constitutionally questionable solution that has been resolved for 80 years in the courts. But nevertheless, if the court, the administration and the Congress wanted to do something that would have raised zero constitutional questions, they probably could have done a public option much easier. But there was no political will for that. So, you know, Ray's frustration is the frustration of a lot of people who say that that the administration just walked into a constitutional briar patch. It could have easily avoided. I mean, this is something that they could have done in other ways. And one of the paradoxes is, and a lot of supporters of the public option have said, if the courts scuttle this current plan, or if it is repealed, the administration can come back with the plan that they hate even more,
right,
and there won't be a constitutional issue.
Yeah. Whoa. as if we thought, you know, we were done with all this health care talk, which lasted about a year. We were so wrong, right? It keeps going on. Ray, thanks for the call. Rick in Milwaukee, hello.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I come from this topic from a business owner's perspective and an individual basis as well. Because of the healthcare issue, I don't want to get too far off topic, but because of the healthcare issue, I'm managing partner of a $20 million company, and because of healthcare costs and escalating costs, I sold 25% of my company to a much larger organization to spread out our healthcare costs. Got about 35 employees, but so there's a lot of factors that go on here. As a business owner, whenever you're dealing with such complex issues, you need to address them and simplify them. It just seems to baffle me how we continue, as you just laughed before this, we continue to make it more and more complex that the public, there's no way that we can comprehend, you know, how this program can work moving forward. There's so many moving pieces to it. Even with the new program moving forward, and the gentleman who was a union member made a very good point, is we still are not going to address the true issue of what cost is. I got to ask a question that maybe I'm not aware of, and maybe you guys can answer this for me. Even though I am an entrepreneur and a business owner, is it true that in the public utility industry, they are maxed a certain amount of profit that they can make without gouging the American public on a percentage of basis? Why couldn't we do something to provide healthcare middlemen a profit, or healthcare-based companies a max amount of profit, so there isn't, the cost is absolutely non-sustainable. I don't care what program we come up with until we address the cost. Is that true that the public utilities, and maybe someone can speak to this?
All right, Dahlia?
You know, I don't have an answer. I'm sorry, I come to this as a as a constitutional writer, not as a healthcare writer, but I it's a great question. But I think underlying both of the last two callers' questions, there are these just very pragmatic problems with ballooning healthcare costs, with the health insurance industry that has all, you know, upside down incentives in this country, and with a plan that gave more power and authority to the health insurers rather than less. You know, the only thing that I can say sort of directly responsive to the last two callers that I haven't already said is that, and this I guess also goes to your initial question about why we need the public option to make this work, is that the Congressional Budget Office reported last year that $43 billion in 2008 was footed by those were bills, healthcare bills that were footed by the rest of us, those of us who pay for health insurance, and that is unsustainable. It is unsustainable for people to say, this is inactivity. You are regulating my decision to do nothing if, in fact, you are someday going to be rushed to the emergency and have your kidney taken out. So I think that this sort of lie at the heart of the constitutional question here, again, I can't answer the public policy question. Mm-hmm. But the lie at the heart of the constitutional question is that all those Americans who choose not to purchase health insurance will never require health care. And that we know, because of the ballooning costs we're talking about, we know as a factual matter that's not correct.
Mm-hmm. We'll all be participants in the health care system in some fashion.
Exactly. And David Cole has Professor David Cole has a very, very good piece in the New York Review of Books where he sort of says, he makes this point that, you know, the idea that nobody is going to be forced to purchase health insurance and that, you know, that the insurers are going to sort of run the system really in the end of the day would mean that nobody would have an incentive to purchase health insurance. If we're not all in the pool, there's an incentive to be out of the pool and just buy health insurance on the way to the ER with the gunshot wound to your leg.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Rick, thanks for the call. Let us go to Diane from Milwaukee. Hello, Diane.
Good morning. If this is Obamacare is unconstitutional, then is the Bush plan for drugs unconstitutional because you are required to take Part D when you're 65? And if you don't take an insurance plan at 65, when you do finally take the drug plan, you are assessed a penalty forever?
I think that's exactly the right question, and what Diane, I think, is asking is what someone like Lawrence Tribe is pointing out in his New York Times piece, which is we just don't live in a country anymore where small agrarian farmers make local decisions and they don't affect interstate commerce, and so you can say, oh, the federal government can't force me to purchase anything or do anything. At least since the New Deal, the courts have acknowledged that in order for the federal government to effectuate the kinds of ends that the federal government has, they need to be allowed to regulate, intensively regulate, interstate commerce. And that doesn't just mean I'm shipping my wheat to Nebraska. That means, since 1937, that the Congress can regulate me growing wheat in my backyard for my own use and the use of my family. It never goes on a truck. And the Supreme Court in the 1930s says that affects interstate commerce because aggregated across America, that affects interstate markets. And that is exactly, by the way, the decision that the U.S. Supreme Court, concurring opinions by Justice Antonin Scalia, arguably the most conservative justice on the court, makes about medicinal marijuana in 2005. That even though you're growing it in a little pot in your kitchen, and you're doing it in California where it's legal and you're using it for medicinal purposes, you are not shipping it anywhere. It has nothing to do with interstate commerce. And Justice Scalia and the court vote that this is implicated by the Commerce Clause. It is not unconstitutional to regulate it because it affects interstate markets. And so I think that, you know, what the caller is saying, and I think this is what Larry Tribe is saying and the supporters of Obamacare are saying, is that the days in which the government can't make you do all sorts of things that you don't want to do and call it interstate commerce have been over for 80 years. And this is a novel and interesting lawsuit because it tries to upend that theory, but it is a theory that, as a constitutional matter, has been resolved for decades.
Thanks very much, Diane, for the call. Let's go back to the states for a moment. Is there some burden, do you think, that the states will have to take on should this individual mandate take place? Is there some burden concerning Medicaid? Is there something that they feel they're being asked to do as a result of this that they just don't have the funds to do?
I think so, although, you know, my understanding, again, I'm not an expert on healthcare policy, but my understanding is that they're getting federal funds to do much of what they're being asked to do, and that some of them are taking the federal funds and then declining to do what they're being asked to do. So I suspect it differs by state, and I suspect different states are reacting different ways, but there is no question that some states are saying this is simply too burdensome for any number of reasons. As I said, that kicks up a very, very complicated, not legal, but political calculus about whether you really want to stand in the way of this, particularly, I think, if you're taking federal funds to do it.
So, Dahlia, is it really all political? Is that what the heart of this is?
You know, I couldn't be a Supreme Court reporter if I thought it was.
Really?
If it was, I would be a congressional reporter. Hmm. I think that what you are seeing playing out in the op-ed pages, you know, the sort of, at the end of the day, disputes between the Professor Tribes and the Randy Barnetts and the people who are looking at this through the prism of doctrine and precedent and constitutional history, and the people who are saying, oh, come on. We saw it in Bush v. Gore. We're going to see it again. Every single person at the Supreme Court is a profoundly political actor, and this is going to be decided in much the way Bush v. Gore was, based on who they voted for in the last elections and not doctrine. And I think maybe this is just, you know, my Patty Hearst syndrome speaking, but I don't think the court works that way. I think that at the end of the analysis, the court does have to answer to public opinion. The court doesn't want to do a Bush v. Gore every 10 years. And I think more profoundly, there are really complicated factors here that have to do with the court striking down a duly enacted piece of legislation. This isn't the court deciding the Florida election. This is the court striking down the president's signature piece
yes,
of legislation.
Yes, exactly. It's a big thing.
Huge, huge
right.
act. And I think that, you know, the other sort of complicating factor in this, and I'll just flick at it, is that I think in the same year that the Supreme Court is forced to contend with health reform, they may also be contending with the Prop 8 challenge coming out of the California courts, the gay marriage question,
oh my gosh,
and the Arizona immigration law.
Oh my.
So not to confound you even further, but I think once the court is making nakedly political decisions, the justices also need to contend with the fact that they don't want to do three Bush v. Gores in 1 year, and that may be barreling down upon them.
So if by chance it's a 5-4 decision, are you going to become a congressional reporter?
You know, I suspect I'm still going to be in the camp that says I don't think this is going to be a 5-4 decision. I think that Justice Scalia, as I suggested, talking about that medicinal marijuana case in 2005, wrote a very, very strong concurring opinion saying, of course, this can be regulated under the Necessary and Proper Clause, under the Commerce Clause. I think that Justices Chief Justice Robert and Sam Alito, two people that often are sort of fluffed into that 5-4 of conservatives, I think that they wrote a very, very important opinion last year about incarcerating sexual predators that would make it very, very hard for them to turn around and strike down health reform. In other words, I think each of these justices is very much cabined and constrained by their own precedent, and they are going to be reluctant, I think, for five of them to willy-nilly put aside everything they've written. The one exception, by the way, is Clarence Thomas, who's been quite consistent that everything has happened since the 1930s in American jurisprudence is wrong. He wouldn't have to put aside anything. He's been very, very, very definitive on his Commerce Clause and necessary and proper jurisprudence. But I think that to imagine that you could get four other justices willing to put aside everything they've thought and written about the Commerce Clause, Necessary and Proper Clause, and simply vote what they would vote at the ballot box, I don't think we're going to see that. If we see it, why don't you call me in a year and a half, and I will probably have an office somewhere in the Dirksen building.
You're on. We'll make that deal right here, right now. Let's go to Stephen from Fish Creek. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. I don't know if I'd have to qualify myself as being right or left wing, but there's an issue that has to do with the fact that the kind of health care that I believe in isn't even covered. If you want to be proactive and go to a Chinese medicine doctor who does acupuncture and herbs, or a massage therapist, or I'm not even sure if chiropractic is covered.
And all right. Well, what do you think about what we're trying to talk about here this hour? Do you think that the Obama health care bill should be struck down on constitutional grounds?
Yes. Yeah, indeed, because they didn't go far enough. We have a station wagon that's totally here to serve the insurance industry. Pills and surgery medicine and the insurance industry are the failing of our entire health care system. And now we've just been all served up as a main course.
It's interesting to listen to the range of feedback. It makes you really, it does crystallize the fact that the administration had to thread a needle between people who wanted to go very much farther, you know, much closer to a Canadian system, and people who would have balked at anything and are now balking at a market-based, you know, insurance-based plan as going way too far. So it seems to me that the real lesson here, again, as a political matter, not a legal matter, is that trying to split the difference sometimes results in everybody hating what you did. And I think it really goes to one of your earlier questions about, the messaging of this thing, that nobody seems to be happy with it. And I think that, you know, whether that has any impact on the courts, you know, really is one of the most interesting questions I've been covering the courts for 12 years, have ever witnessed, is whether you're seeing judges emboldened by the fact that the polls reflect a deep unhappiness with this piece of legislation. I guess the one thing I would say is that supporters of this bill say that every signature piece of legislation that has been sort of controversial has been struck down before it was upheld, and that this is what happens, that the courts, the lower courts, strike the thing down, and at the end of the day, the upper, the higher courts uphold it, and that this is part of the dance that we do, and we may just be seeing the first steps of that very same dance.
Dahlia Lithwick is our guest this hour, senior editor for Slate.com, author of Jurisprudence, The Law, Lawyers, and the Court. And we are talking about the health care bill and what's happened in the courts. Pretty even split here. Democratically appointed judges, two of them have said this bill's okay. Two Republican appointed judges have said it's unconstitutional. Eventually, it will go to the Supreme Court. There is a member of Congress who's now asking this week that the Supreme Court fast track this. So what do you think? Is it unconstitutional or not, is our question of the hour. And we'll take more phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here we have a couple emails that have come in. Ed from Sturgeon Bay, please explain how the requirement to pay for Social Security and Medicare is apparently constitutional, but the requirement to pay for health insurance is unconstitutional.
Well, that's Lawrence Tribe's piece today. But Lawrence Tribe in the New York Times today says in 1982 the Supreme Court unanimously recognized that it's difficult, if not impossible, to maintain the financial soundness of the Social Security system if people could opt out, and so it was upheld. And I think that that's exactly, you know, I think I've been trying to argue that there's been this slow march of regulations that look a lot like this that have been constitutional, and what Tribe and the other supporters of the law say is this is no different, making exactly the same point as your emailer, that the idea that this is radical and nothing like this has ever been attempted has been, again, as a messaging technique to say this is absolutely unprecedented. It's been very effective, but I think that the supporters of the law would say this is one of a long, 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 long line since the 1930s of sort of post-New Deal regulations that have been not only upheld by the courts, but seen as uncontroversial in the courts, and this is no different from those.
Jeff in Madison, hi.
Yes, hi. My response is about health care, and it's not totally off topic. I agree with the union official or member who called in about needing something else, the public option, which I have always been a proponent of and still am. But my feeling is that we will never have this. We will never build up enough steam in the engine to push for national health care until everyone else starts to lose it, including, and I hate to say this, Kathleen, and I said this to your screener, including state employees. I when Scott Walker said you're cutting health benefits, my first reaction was, oh, that's terrible. My second was, well, there's another group who will push harder. And as long as state employees and company employees and everyone else and probably professors at universities have health care provided by their organization, we will never build up that head of steam. And until we can do that, we're just going to be fiddling with this mess forever. And that's not so much a question as a comment, but I'll listen off air now.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dahlia.
I agree. I think that, this was single payer wasn't given any sort of meaningful shot by the administration. And then a lot of the people that I cover were so, so disenchanted that the administration didn't try a little bit harder to do something like single payer. But I also think, this is an interesting, it's a really interesting comment about what the resistance to the Obama plan has been. The resistance has been about personal liberty. It's been all about, right, it's the broccoli argument. The government can't kind of come in and peer in my windows and tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really interesting tension because this isn't an individual liberty constitution. There's no constitutional issue that is being raised here about individual liberty. This is raised as a state's rights problem, right? This is, the Commerce Clause is about the states can do this, not the federal government. There is nothing going on at the Constitution level that says individuals have to be free from government telling them what to do. And so I think that, again, we've talked over and over in the past hour about how cleverly this has been framed by the opponents to the law. And I think the thing that they've done so deftly and that we have to recognize is make this sound as though it's about my personal freedom to be free from the government telling me what to do. That is not the constitutional issue that has been raised here. It is not the issue that the courts are going to decide. It is the issue that is being decided on radio and on television and, at the corner barbershop, but it has never been the constitutional question here.
Mark in Appleton, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling, the previous caller talked about public utilities and limiting profits. It's my understanding that part of the health care bill is that 85% of health insurance revenue has to go towards reimbursements for health care, so that there is some process in there that limits, even profits in terms of the health of the health insurance. And then one other comment. I mean, it is frustrating for me that somehow a lot of people are able to talk about a government takeover of healthcare when this really is not a government takeover of healthcare. It is simply regulating insurance. And it is rather frustrating that politicians somehow are allowed to just kind of say all this, and commentators do what they want, but politicians are never called on the fact that they're just not really being accurate when they talk about a government takeover of healthcare. I mean, it's no more government takeover of healthcare than the auto insurance industry, which is also regulated, or the fact that our foods and drugs are regulated by the government.
Dahlia.
No, I think that's right, and I think that that dovetails so nicely with what I was just saying about individual liberty. The idea that every single part of our life isn't regulated by either the federal government or the state government is a fallacy, and one of the things that I think someone like Michelle Bachmann or some of the Tea Party, you know, kind of constitutional revisionism has effectuated is this myth that we all, you know, live out on farms in Montana and the government doesn't have anything to do with us, and so why should they be able to make us purchase health care? And as your caller just said, that's simply not true. Every part of our lives, from what we eat to what we drive, is regulated. And so the real challenge would be to say, why is this different? And they've, I think, achieved that. The opponents of the bill have achieved that with a little bit of a rhetorical sleight of hand by saying, oh, this is regulating inactivity as opposed to activity, right? You're not purchasing something as opposed to purchasing something, and that's the difference. But as I've said several times, for 80 years, that distinction has not had any constitutional meaning. So I think we need to be very, very precise in our terms when we talk about what is different here, what is unprecedented here, what is a sea change here. There isn't one. The sea change has been in the rhetoric and the pushback, and it's been very, very powerful and very, very effective. But as a legal matter, there has been no change.
And the whole thing is just bizarre in a way when you put it down to what you just said, that you can, the conservatives would say that when you're engaged in commerce, then you can be regulated. But if you choose not to engage in commerce, then you're not regulated. It comes down to this very narrow thing, doesn't it?
It's very narrow. And if it weren't for Justice Antonin Scalia writing the concurrence in the medicinal marijuana case only 6 years ago, that argument might have some force. The fact is, it hasn't had force, because if even Justice Scalia says, it doesn't matter that nobody is going to buy your little
it's
pot
just
plant.
You
it
and
doesn't
your
matter.
House. Uh-huh.
It's not engaged in interstate commerce. The minute you have lost Justice Scalia, it seems to me this conversation should be over.
Thank you. It is over for us. I'm sorry. Thank you so much. It was really an interesting hour. Thanks, Dahlia.
Thanks for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick. Her book is Jurisprudence, The Law, Lawyers, and the Court. She's senior editor of Slate. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and for on-air production.